Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here. I'm Rosaria Munson. I'm acting chair of classics. And I'm going to start by saying a few things about the institution of the Helen North Lectureship and the person whom it honors. As many of you know, this is an annual event that was instituted by the late Charles Ruff and Susan Willis Ruff, both class of 1960, and is still supported by many others, mostly Swarthmore alumni and former students of Helen North. Helen North's 93rd birthday would have been January 31st of this year. She was Centennial Professor of Classics. She taught at Swarthmore from 1948 to 1991. She was, needless to say, an authority in the field, former president of the American Philological Association, among many other accomplishments, and the author of several articles and books, especially the important book, Sophrosyne, on the ancient concept of self-control, published in 1966 and still widely cited. As a teacher and longtime chairman, Professor North has touched the lives of many of us, of many of her students, and some of them are present in the audience tonight. And she has been, of course, instrumental in shaping the department to have the program of classics to have the rigor that it still has today. We miss her very much, and we wish that she could still be with us. She would certainly have been particularly proud to welcome today's speaker as Helen North Lecturer. He is Christopher Pelling, the Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford University. And for those of you who are too young to remember, I will say that the chair of Regius Professor of Greek was instituted by Henry VIII in 1541. You didn't know the date, did you? Okay. I Googled it. He created five Regius Professorships in Oxford, some corresponding ones in Cambridge, in different disciplines, but the important thing to remember is that there is only one Regius Professor of Greek in all of Oxford University, which is the place most populated by classics that I've ever seen. And the one and only, is here with us tonight. So when he took that position almost 11 years ago, that was the culmination of a long career at Oxford that started when he was an undergraduate at Balliol College, and then he was a senior scholar at Christ Church. Then he went off for 2 years in the early 70s to be a research fellow in this other place, Cambridge, after which he came back to Oxford and as tutor and fellow at University College, and there he remained for 29th year until he then took his present post as a Regius Professor, and he is now back at Christ Church College. But I have to say that also during this long period of time, he has been visiting professor in many institutions in the United States, for Washington Lee University, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Utah State and University, University of Texas at Austin, University of Wisconsin, the list sort of goes on and on. This is going to be like catalog poetry today. Well, it is hard to do justice in a short time to Professor Pelling's immense role in the field of classics, both as a scholar, but also on the pedagogical outreach side. And you will soon discover for yourself what an engaging, erudite, inspiring speaker he is. But in his most public role, and this is relatively recent news, he has been appointed by the Minister of Education, Michael Gove, to lead a new collaborative initiative promoting the professional development for teachers of classics or Latin in Britain state schools. This is a very personal cause for him because he is himself the product of a state school education, having attended the Cardiff High School in Wales in the 60s, where he started Latin. So I learned because somebody told him that it would be a good preparation for being a lawyer. And that's precisely, it's true, right? And that's precisely where he became hooked on classics, which is a very good thing for all of us. Also because he has been an especially lively and active voice of those voices talking classics, not only to scholars, but also to general audiences in that animated conversation that is going on right now about all aspects of the ancient world, especially, I must say, in Britain through publications such as the Times Literary Supplement, radio, television, internet, and so on. So now we get to the really serious stuff. Of course, Professor Specialized Scholarship is extensive. He's the author of 104 articles and chapters. They are too numerous to describe or even name by title, even though many of them are really close to my heart because many of them on Herodotus, they introduce ideas that are always innovative and different about this author. For example, the constant confusion and conflation that this author makes between East and West, the problematicity of logos, and other ideas on which we very much depend. But I will limit myself to mentioning some of the items that sort of sit independently on the shelf, starting with commentaries. He has one on Plutarch's Life of Antony, Cambridge University Press, 1988. Another on Plutarch's Lives of Philopoemen Flamininus. This is in Italian, published by Rizzoli in 1997, but I hear that there is an English version due to Peer. And also I should mention among the commentaries, although it is still in preparation, the one on Herodotus Book 6 that he is writing in collaboration with Simon Horblower from All Souls College, Oxford. He has also written a translation of introduction and commentary of Plutarch's Life of Caesar, that's 2011, and he has collaborated in producing the Penguin translation that go, you know, with commentary, translation commentary and so on, that go under the editorial titles of Rome in Crisis, Nine Lives by Plutarch, or Plutarch, The Rise of Rome. And his author books, yeah, I told you this was catalog, probably poetry. His author books include Literary Text and the Greek Historian, Plutarch and History, 2002. And particularly intriguing to me is the one that is coming out right now that he wrote with Maria Wyke called 12 Voices from Greece and Rome, Ancient Ideas for Modern Times, which I just learned includes a chapter on Sappho, which includes a discussion of the recent Sappho material that has been discovered. He has also edited several collections, among which Characterization and Individuality in Greek Literature, 1919 Oxford, and Greek Tragedy in the Historian, 1997. You know, we should really pay attention to this kind of title, Greek Tragedy and the Historian, Literary Text and the Greek Historian, because they give a clue of one of the main contribution of Professor Pelling to our field, namely his showing that literary criticism and historical criticism are not separate areas of studies, but rather they're necessarily related and mutually informing areas of inquiry. And of course, we are not only speaking about literary criticism of historiographical texts like Herodotus and Thucydides, but also oratory and even poetic or fictional works like tragedy and comedy. If we read them with awareness of their generic requirements and their rhetorical requirements, so to speak, the rhetorical agenda, all these texts yield a profound understanding of what really happened. This is what he argues again and again, at least insights of what think thought or the way people represented what really happened. And so Christopher Pelley is also at the forefront of persuading us that contemporary theoretical perspectives like narratology, reader response, criticism, and so on, if used sensibly, can enhance our understanding of classical texts and in turn also of history itself. Now, especially important in this respect, in the way that it combines history and literature, is his work on Plutarch, the Greek literary artist who wrote both about Greek and Roman history, and who is the subject of today's lecture. So I will leave you with Christopher Pelling, who will speak about parallel nostalgias, Plutarch on the Greek and Roman past. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rosaria, for that extremely generous introduction. And I'm so grateful to be here. So it's an extreme honor to be here in honoring Helen North's memory. My first time in Swarthmore, not my first time in Pennsylvania, but a delight to come here, see so many familiar faces in the audience as well. Thank you so much for coming. And it's a particular pleasure to visit Swarthmore. I never met Helen North. I'm very sorry about that. Of course, I know her work and admire it immensely. But it's a great shame that this is honoring her memory rather than her. But I did know Martin Oswalt, and first met him when indeed I was an undergraduate, an extremely nondescript undergraduate, and he was held a very grand visiting fellowship in my college, and there was absolutely no reason why he should give the time of day to this Commonwealth Garden undergraduate, and even less reason why he should remember me several years later when we met at a conference and greet me like an old friend, but he did, and it meant an awful lot to me, as meeting Martin so many times did afterwards. So I say I'm very sorry I never met Helen North, but I suspect that she would have got on quite well with Plutarch, really. Both were profoundly, deeply interested in ethics, both had a particular admiration for Plato. Both were people of extreme elegance, style, both wrote very well indeed, with sometimes a twinkle in the eye, I think, on showing through on the page. And as so often when people write about ethics, both were particularly interesting and insightful when talking about the way that ethics could go wrong. And today's theme is pretty well the opposite of sophrosyne, I suppose, self-control and self-restraint. It's decadence and the nostalgia for better times past, sometimes quite often nostalgia for probably a golden time that never was. But I'd like to think that Helen North would have been interested in decadence too, probably with that twinkle in the eye. So money talks, so they say. Unfortunately, it's not always clear exactly what it says or what people say about it. And that's especially true when that characteristic link of money and decadence comes into view. Plutarch is writing in the late first, early century CE. He's writing deep in Greece in his hometown of Chaeronea in Boeotia. But he traveled fairly widely. He'd certainly got to Rome, and he'd have seen conspicuous expenditure in plenty there, the Golden House of Nero, of course, and more. His greatest work is Parallel Lives, taking one great Roman, one great Greek at a time, comparing them with one another, often, not quite always, with a comparative epilogue at the end. Sometimes the different ways you could think about wealth and money come out very clearly, even if the different voices are all identifiably part of the same personality, but they're not always saying quite the same thing. There are moments when he develops a picture of primeval simplicity, when everything was marvelous and there was no acquisitiveness at all. And that's especially true when he thinks of Rome, even more so, actually, when he thinks about Sparta. And that's introducing a theme that will come back a lot. But he talks a bit more about Sparta in this context and a bit less about Rome than we would expect. But one is sometimes reminded of all those Latin poets who think longingly of a time when a boy could get a girl with a gift of an apple and save so much trouble, didn't it, really? Just as those metrosexual poets would not really have been altogether at comfort in a world of the apple-loving and easy giving. At least we think that. Perhaps I think we think they think that too. Just as a move from an apple and favours economy might have something to be said for it. In the same way, Plutarch knows that money has its uses too. He's got a fascinating essay, many of you will know, on advice on public life, advising a young person in the Greek city of Sardis of the right way of making one's progress. And he paints there a much more realistic picture of how wealth might be used in a Greek city in that world of private riches and ostentatious public benefaction. I put some passages in note one on the handout. He may not like that world much. He himself recommends a much more enlightened demagogy. It's based on logos, it's based on persuasive oratory, it's based on caring leadership, setting a model, much more than on paying for public doles and games. But he's realistic. He knows that those doles and games, that's the world in which one's got to move. Discussion there centres on the sort of benefactions and disbursements which a rich politician needs to perform, not to whether on whether he ought to do the sort of thing at all. There are even a few opportunities to do a friend a favour. Let's put a little money-making possibilities the way of a friend. Sort of cronyism that, of course, we're thoroughly unfamiliar with. But Plutarch doesn't throw up his hands in horror at all this. And in this lecture, I'll push this a little further and explore this variety of mindset even within the lives themselves, in particular its connection with moral decadence and decay. And in particular, I'll be keeping an eye on the way in which Plutarch adapts his moralism to the nasty, rough world of Rome, where wealth played so large and often so corrupt a role. One introductory point is a purely statistical one. Of course, there's more words than one for decadent luxury, and this isn't just a lexical game. But if there's one Greek word that we'd expect to find more than any other in this context, it's the word trophé and associated words. Luxury, licentiousness, excess, quite often used of a sort of mindset, a sort of nonchalant, perhaps over-nonchalant, rather uncaring and casual mindset that goes with that sort of luxury. And we certainly find a lot of trophé about. It's not difficult to find cases where trophé attaches to the cultures where, in terms of a tradition before Plutarch, we'd most expect it to. It's usually an Eastern thing, very often an Eastern thing, and Persia and the East are often indeed luxurious. Trophousi. But also some cases in Rome, and I've put some cases there in handout too. And it's clear enough that he's very familiar with what we so often find a commonplace atop us in the Roman historians of moral decline and its connections with reckless expenditure, luxurious excess, one of the things that goes badly wrong with Rome. But the very casualness of the way he introduces that in a passage I've put there in the Life of Sulla is quite telling, I think. It's just there in a genitive absolute clause before he goes on to make the point that interests him more. Now, given that lifestyles had changed, and the point that interests him more is that basically even in a society like that, Sulla ran into criticism for getting too rich too quick after a humble start. Yet if one looks at where one actually finds these words occurring and as a theme, there's still a good deal less of it in the Roman lives than one would expect. There is some, especially in the life of Lucullus, first century BCE Roman statesman, who really put his back into enjoying his degenerate and excessive old age. Even there, it's not so much a point about Rome as a whole, just about the man himself. And he also figures, in fact, in one of the other political essays, Should an Old Man Take Part in Public Life? And there he's a prime example of a man who collapsed into a sort of reprehensible retirement. I'm so much looking forward to myself. 445 days' time. But lives that really go in for discussing trophy are the ones where perhaps we might least have expected it, and so the Spartan ones, where, as you can see from the figures there, we're about three times as likely to come across a trophy word than we do in the Athenian lives. Of course, the Athenian lives include Alcibiades, who's perhaps the naughtiest boy of them all, or in the Roman. And again, handout three, we're in there. There's something of the same phenomenon with riches, with plut or plus words, plutos, plusios. Though the discrepancy is less marked, it's easy living, even more than wealthy living, that's in point. Now, of course, it's a very crude indication. Quite often the point is not that Sparta is just trophée-ridden, but that various Spartans, especially Lycurgus, the lawgiver at the beginning, and Agis and Cleomenes, the kings at the end, were so intent on stamping it out. But it does reflect the way that at least trophée is a theme in the Spartan lives, much more so than in the Roman, if we take both groups as a whole. Still, perhaps the most striking statistical point at all is the way that the most frequent occurrences have all come in the comparative epilogues. And that confirms the way that wealth, luxury, are so often important in weighing up the moral balance between the Greek and Roman figures. Sometimes that's in terms of what they do for the state, that's true of what Lycurgus does for Sparta, Numa for Rome, or perhaps more often, the way they actually behave themselves, quite how luxurious and wealth-ridden they are. Don't want to stress the statistical point too much. Doesn't demonstrate much, perhaps indeed doesn't demonstrate anything. But I do suggest it reflects something important in the lives and something that I hope the rest of this will do more to demonstrate. And that is this surprising prominence of the theme of luxury in those Spartan lives and the relative absence of it, the mutedness, shall we say, of the Roman lives on the topic. Now, what we do with that insight is another question. One tempting first bid, and it's always a mistake to say, well, let's start off with something. It's an undergraduate lecture, they always take that down, and then that's all they remember. This is a first bid, but it's not going to last, okay? Okay, that's not how I'm going to end up. But a first bid would be to remember that Plutarch was a Greek under what has been called the Roman occupation. I'm sure I quite accept that word myself, but okay. Rome now dominates Greece. And you might think that he's sensible enough not to write anything too disapproving about those above. Haunting phrase he uses, the very powerful men above, that he calls the Romans in that advice on public life. I don't think myself it's going to work, as we'll see later on, but it's reasonable to remember that historical context. One of the ways that we might be doubtful about that is to remember the extremely pointed things that he says at times, and I'll come about this more at the end, so forgive me for looking at a passage immediately at the end of a handout. I want to come back to it more relevant later, but it's relevant here as well. In passage 15 there on the handout, it's there in the comparison of Lycurgus and Numa. Did not Rome make her great advances through warfare, he has somebody suggest. Oh, well, that's a question requiring a lengthy answer for men who define advance in terms of wealth, luxury, and empire, rather and safety, restraint, and an honest independence. Ooh, that's quite bold, actually. Somebody can be that bold about Rome, and you'll notice also talking about wealth and luxury there, is not, I think, going to be so cowed as I've started off by suggesting, but we'll come around to that. One other thing that we might get out of that Lycurgus and Numa passage is to remember where it comes. It's there in the comparison at the end, comparing the lawgiver Lycurgus and the one Roman who wasn't particularly a biffer or an expander, the pious early King Numa. And there it's a point about Rome, but in a way it's also a point more about Sparta. It's a point about all the militarism and successes that Sparta made. So in that particular passage, talking about Rome is in a place we wouldn't expect it, but is an indirect way of talking about Sparta. That might suggest another version of the first bid, a slightly more nuanced bid. Perhaps he feels, we might say, the need to be a little indirect when talking about Rome. So might it in fact be that talking about Sparta, a sort of inverse of that, can also be a way of suggesting points that could the reader could, if he or she wished, apply to Rome. So could it be an indirect rather than a direct commentary on Rome itself? Well, that's a possibility as well, and I think there maybe will be something in that. But I think also think that there's something else as well that leads him to tiptoe so delicately about Roman easy living. I'll suggest what it is in about 11 minutes' time, I think. First, though, a little more on Sparta, Spartan wealth. It all started with that Lycurgan austerity. It was also, in note 4 by now, a prophecy that the love of money will be what it is that would destroy Sparta, love of money and nothing else. And sometimes, I suppose just developing a point I've just made, Plutarch is explicit about the way in which the two worlds of Sparta specifically, not Greece as a whole, and Rome can be compared. How Sparta might have lessons for Rome in that same comparison of Lycurgus and Numa, back in note 4 still. He wishes that Numa had done what Lycurgus did and introduced an equality of wealth from the beginning. That would have prevented all those later evils which greed would bring. That Roman greed, which occupied Roman Greece had seen so much of, with all those great works of art, for instance, all somehow managing to end up in Rome by now. But first, let's see if there's a bit more to be said about the way that he develops that comparison of Sparta and Rome, and just take one particular, rather complicated pairing, admittedly, to see how he develops that. And that's one of the less studied pairs, in fact, a rather complicated double life. He only does this once, where he takes two Greeks and compares with two Romans, Agis and Cleomenes, those Spartan kings, and the aristocratic Roman reformers, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. Wealth soon comes into that pair. The disastrous impact of wealth on Sparta in the generations after the Peloponnesian War, and the crisis this caused for the long-standing Lycurgan constitution, note 5 there, when the eagerness for silver and gold first infiltrated the city, the acquisition of wealth brought with it greed, meanness, where its use and enjoyment brought luxury, effeminacy, and extravagance. So Sparta lost most of what was good, suffered a time of unworthy humiliation until that period, when Agis and Cleomenes were kings. The wealth by then had become concentrated in women's hands. Shock, horror, as bad as that. And it's an interesting new step from what we have in the life of Lycurgus. Wealth is becoming feminized. And indeed, the women of a royal house become key players there. They're wealthy. They're also quite idealistic. It's not simply, it's not simple misogyny. It's quite complicated misogyny. They're persuaded, perhaps over-persuaded, by the idealistic Agis, and they play a role in persuading the young Cleomenes to try to reform degenerate Sparta, bring back the old ways. Finally, the women are exemplary in where, when it comes to the crisis and in their own deaths. Interestingly, this is picking up a very familiar theme from the way in which 5th century, inventing the barbarian works, wealth is also barbarized as well, feminized, barbarized. It's interesting in this decadent Sparta order by them, one of the defenders of the new luxurious order is a certain man called Leonidas. And he'd picked up his decadent ways in the East, courts of satraps and of Seleucus. So wealth is barbarized, wealth is feminized. There are developments here of the idea of Sparta as a sort of internal Greek other, which has attracted interest in the scholarship on Herodotus. Paul Cartlidge, for instance, has been heavy there. And I guess his program, Ben Cleomenes, is to confront this new orientalized order with the older Lycurgan system. Let's turn the clock back. Now, even in Agis and Cleomenes, though, one can trace that more realistic strand as well. Wealth works. It's maybe the imported curse of Sparta. That's a phrase that's used once. Also jolly useful. It's in this life, indeed, that Plutarch elaborately expresses his approval of the old proverb that money is the sinews of a fair. Did I put that? It's in fact in chapter 48. I didn't put the phrase down there, but it's in the context there in note 6. King Cleomenes has paraded his asceticism. He doesn't need money, but then in fact it's the lack of money, shortage of cash, that ensures his final defeat. It's actually a very familiar way in which Plutarch sets up quite a lot of lives. It's a schema where an individual's strengths, perhaps the factors that build his strengths, turn around and eventually are destructive and decisive in bringing people down. Pompey's popularity that leads him to overestimate his support in Italy. Caesar's support with his army and the people, but they turn against him when everything turns sour. And it's a bit of the same sort of thing here. Wealth was the keynote of what Cleomenes was parading, but it now turns against him. It ends up, his shortage is bringing him down. And we're not far from that sense of realism then that I talked about in the Advice on Public Life in his own day. So money, complicated theme in Agis and Cleomenes. There's a play between that idealized view of these two kings, the realities of a world in which they have to live. What about the Gracchi then and the rough political world of Rome? Well, certainly some similarities of theme. We're now into handout 7. Here too, the women of the family are highlighted, they're most laudable, especially the brother's formidable mother Cornelia, one of these great Roman matrons, not something to meet on a dark night, but really dominate the stage. Here too, Eastern wealth becomes important, the sudden windfall of money that comes in from Pergamum. And here too, there's a bit of a suspicion of over-Oriental tastes. Tiberius is found scratching his head one day. He's calling for a diadem, they say. Oh, come on. But it makes a difference. There are certainly similarities in the predicament. It's not a place to argue it in detail. I have argued it elsewhere. I think we can show that Plutarch has simplified his source material to make it much more of a simple matter of wealth and its abuse than it was in his sources. And sources seem to have made it a more complicated matter of military manpower. The rich may be evil, but they've been buying up all the land, and the emphasis is on the evil rich as much as on the land in Plutarch. The Gracchan proposal in Plutarch, it's aimed against injustice and greed. It's the money stuff again. The opponents are avariciously selfish, and again, a lot more emphasis falls on that. But there's something else going on in the Gracchi, lives of the Gracchi too, and it's really interesting. It's something that has been brought out quite a lot in recent research, I think, on Plutarch. A generation ago, we started realizing that the pairings are much more important in rather the way I've just been talking about, the same themes coming back. There's now much more of an interest in saying, well, perhaps it goes beyond the pairings, that in a way, all the lives can go together, at least in a qualified way, combining to provide a history of all of Greece and all of Rome. And I think it's certainly true that the Gracchi go with a lot of the lives of the later period of the Republic. We sense a lot of the themes coming in here that are going to come back later. The growth of violence, the growth of greed, and then increasingly we see, in some of the later lives, the tie of the army to the imposing imposing generals, and it's all going to come back. These themes are going to come back, where the seeds of violence in public life grow into the sort of crisis, something he elsewhere memorably calls the kakopoliteia, the evil state of politics at Rome, that unleashes forces, especially the force of the demos, that eventually even those who promote them, like Caesar, cannot control or resist. So underlying a good deal of this is Plutarch's analysis of what's just now beginning to go wrong with Rome. Well, how is wealth and money, given we've seen that there's a lot on that, going to tie in? Those of you who know Roman historians will have a pretty good idea of what to expect there. We know what Sallust would have done. We know what Sallust more or less did do. It's so tempting. Something along the lines of private greed causing all the problems, the influx of wealth making it worse, it eventually becoming the people's greed as well. This is all very Sallustian. The immoral readiness of the rich to pander to the greed that renders them bribable, all this can take us with things going further downhill to the final crisis of the Republic. So we expect, I suppose, if we're imbricated in Roman historiography, to have wealth as part of that analysis of what's going wrong with Rome. But it's not, interestingly, what Plutarch says. Despite the setting up of a well theme at the beginning in Agis and Cleomenes, there's hardly anything, for instance, on the corrupting effect of wealth. He hardly mentions corruption. He hardly mentions bribery when these demagogues, Gaius Gracchus and Livius Drusus, turn to the people. He somehow manages to explain the reasons for reforming the law courts without mentioning bribery. It's quite a good trick if you can do it. When riches become relevant in the comparative epilogue at the end, it's not in any large world view of what's happening to Sparta or to Rome. It's in a more personal register of a stern determination of the individual protagonists to forego any possibility of personal gain. And here we've got a point that's true not merely of the Gracchi, but more generally. Despite Plutarch's intermittent readiness to idealize the distant past, he's very reluctant to echo that, that disastrous effect of foreign wealth theme at Rome. At Sparta, as we've seen, it's different. He's already stressed the Oriental strands there. So that's again the point I started off by making statistically. He's much more ready to make such points about Sparta than against Rome. And again, why? And we cut this tape back to, it was in fact 12 minutes ago, the answer might well be the way in which that Roman topos of Eastern wealth and Eastern corruption had traditionally become so interwoven with an anti-Hellenic and anti-cultural topos as well. The influx of wealth could so easily be equated with the arrival of Greek statues and works of art and general intellectualism. And not surprisingly, this is not Plutarch's way of looking at things. He feels that Rome ought to have learned a good deal more from Greece. The elder Cato, into point 9 by now in the handout, is criticized strongly for the view that Greek influences would be so disastrous to Rome. Time shows that he was wrong, for the time of Rome's greatest achievements was the time when it was most ready to welcome Greek studies and Greek culture. Very interesting past tenses, incidentally. The great days of Greece, of Rome, are in the past, when they used to listen to us Greeks. So that's another way of trying to explain this slight tiptoeing around a Roman theme. He does not want to suggest that Hellenic influences can be part of that corruption. The nearest he gets to the theme of Eastern decadence is in two cases. First is in the Marcellus, where he catalogues the criticisms that were made of Marcellus at the time, in the Second Punic War, for bringing back the treasures of Syracuse. People said, they didn't seem to bother very much about the poor Syracusans, but they did say he was corrupting the Roman demos, turning them from farming and warfare to luxury and idleness, so they spend most of the day discussing art and artists. It's a lovely picture, isn't it? You know, these sturdy Roman peasants sitting around in the forum there discussing arts and artists. Oh, don't get this Damien Hirst bloke myself. No, I'm more of a Jackson Pollock sort of man myself. It's hardly strong language, I suppose. A large part of Plutarch's sensibilities will surely have been on Marcellus's side. He's civilizing these people. That's what he's doing. He's not corrupting them. Secondly, the second case, more elaborately, Sulla. And the theme, again, one thinks immediately of Sallust, the wealth that accrued from Sulla's conquest, the effect this had at Rome. And there's a long passage that dwells on this theme. It's chapter 12, in fact. Yes, I put the reference there. But the emphasis, again, is not a very Sallustian one. In Plutarch, it's not the case, but it's the Eastern experience that has corrupted Roman tastes and instilled a taste for the easy life. The soldiers' taste for the easy life is there already. All Greece does is offer an opportunity for it to be satisfied. The wealth that corrupts them comes from the shrines which Sulla ransacked. And all the blame is there falling on the Romans themselves. There's nothing wrong with the wealth, particularly when it was in the shrines. Not only in the different emphasis then from Sallus, it's also different from that in some of the Spartan lives, where it was indeed foreign wealth in itself which caused the problems when it started coming into Sparta. So if we get something of a Roman commonplace, we're only getting it in a strikingly off-key way, and one which is much less derogatory about the wealth itself and where it comes from. And we've certainly moved some way from that first bit idea that Plutarch might be reluctant to be rude about those all-conquering Romans. It's just that their vices come from their own greed and not from any sort of Eastern influence. They don't need any help along that decadent road. Now, the example which will take up quite a bit of the second half of what I want to say in my time is Agesilaus and Pompey, another pair, and we'll see something of the same, but the decadence here is going to take a rather different form. Certainly, moral decline plays a part in the life of Pompey, and that's clearest, I suppose, in the scene on the battlefield of Pharsalus on the evening after the battle. I haven't put the passage down, but I put the reference in handout 10. The victorious Caesar arrives in Pompey's camp. He's amazed by the luxury that he sees, tents garlanded with myrtle, flower-strewn couches, tables brimming with goblets. No wonder the tough military men and his troops had won, hardened by all the fighting in Gaul and then in Spain. And this will remind some people who know their Herodotus of another scene, and I'm sure it's meant to. I'm sure of the way the text works, is by summoning up that scene after the Battle of Plataea in Book 9 of Herodotus, where the victorious general Pausanias goes into the Greek, into the Persian camp, sees all the sumptuousness there, and orders his Spartan cooks to cook two meals, one the sumptuous Persian side and one the hardy Spartan fare. It's also interesting in Herodotus, so we don't quite get what we might be expecting and what the text may anyway be suggesting. Pausanias doesn't do the "no wonder we won beating those namby-pamby foreigners because we're chaff." Pausanias says, "Why did they bother? You know, why bother to come all this way to eat meals like that? Why not stay at home?" But anyway, that scene is still there, and the echo is felt in Plutarch, as it's been argued, rightly I think, that it's felt in the parallel passage in Caesar's Gallic War. And here there is more of a suggestion that this is why the Caesar's hardy people will have won. Pompey's people have been a little soft. It's a bit of what we're going to see 17 years later, I suppose, just when Antony and Cleopatra are going to be the orientalized losers against Octavian. But that is indeed 17 years later. We haven't got there yet. There's no Eastern Cleopatra to do the corrupting. The Roman elite on Pompey's side have corrupted themselves. Same point. But we've heard something more elaborate about how and where Rome had gone wrong, and we've heard it earlier on that same day. Before the armies clashed, some wise spectators had mused on the self-destruction of it all. This is the long passage, sorry it's so long, but I'll take you through it in several stages, if I might, as there's so much of interest in it, in fact. So this is handout 11. So just as a signal was being given by both sides and the trumpet was calling for the battle to begin, the ordinary soldiers each considered his own predicament, but a few of the best of the Romans and some Greeks who were there but not participating reflected, now that the danger was at hand, on the plight to which greed and rivalry, Phalanikia, had brought the empire and laid it out before them. A word in the Greek is exethekem, a word that's exactly right for a spectacle. It is all very, very visual. There's a large amount of the tragic theatre around here, a bit of that in note 12. We've had this before. It's it wasn't heaven that prescribed for the Romans, but the plain of Pharsalus should be the stadium and theatre for them to contend for the empire. And the armies take up their position like a chorus. I'll get back to that in a moment. It's interesting that these are the Greek non-participants, some Greeks who were there but not participating. Now, there's good reason to believe that Plutarch's source for this event, usually thought to be Asinius Pollio, writing fairly soon after the events, had a similar passage. But the main reason for thinking that is a parallel set of reflections in the account of Appian, using much the same material. But in Appian, it's not these reflections of the part of these people who are just observers and looking out. It's Caesar and Pompey themselves who are, rather uncharacteristically, overtaken by apprehensiveness at what's about to come. There's nothing there of these best of the Romans and some Greeks who are there but not participating. Perhaps we should think of these as a sort of audience watching in that distinctively theatrical way that combines, I suppose, intense imaginative engagement with also an essential level of detachment. That's what you get in the theatre. Perhaps it might be metatextual. Think of a response of these spectators as somehow a prompt for the response of a reader too, all of us drawn in to imagine ourselves as onlookers too and think visually. And the theatre is also in our mind from that passage a few chapters earlier, again in note 12, the armies took up their positions like a chorus. The texture of what these observers go on to think, let's just go through now, has a good deal, I think, of a tragic chorus about it. It fills a pause before a crisis with reflections on human nature. It moves from the specific to the general, as choruses often do. It opens a worldwide perspective. It's got this vista of distant lands. It wistfully moves through that world of a might have been. And this is indeed, then, a distinctively Greek way of figuring things, if we can put it like that. And it's a way, too, which evokes tragedy, not just in the sense it's all rather sad, not in that debased sense of tragedy, but evoking all those ideas of kindred conflict, of a single household having impact, resonance, whole nation, past hanging over heavily over the present as well, fierce, uncontrollable emotion, bringing inevitable catastrophe. Here were indeed kindred arms, it's the next bit, and battle lines of brothers, and it's neat phrasing there, that the kindred arms suggests the relation of Caesar, the father-in-law, Pompey, the son-in-law, married Caesar's daughter Julia, that marriage of Pompey to Julia that comes back to the end of a passage here. And some will doubtless remember the first line of Lucan, of bella plusquamque vilia, wars that are worse or deeper or more than civil. It's not simply fellow citizens, it's kindred. But then the battle lines of brothers move the perspective more to the armies than to the generals. And there's a certain elegant ambivalence here about whether these observers are really talking about the principals, Caesar and Pompey, or about the armies as a whole, or a bit of both. And notice greed also is central to this analysis, just as there was in Plutarch's study of the Roman armies in his earlier lives of Galba and Otho in the civil wars of 69 CE, put a reference there to handout 13. So once again, there's no reluctance to talk directly about Roman feelings. So here are kindred arms, battle of lines of brothers, common standards, so much manhood and might all falling upon one another. It was a demonstration that human nature, once aroused to emotion, is a blind and frenzied thing. Human nature in the forefront, that might start a trigger. I was talking about Herodotus a few minutes ago. This may be a trigger to the other great 4th century, I suppose, when he's writing historical heavy Thucydides, in whom human nature plays so big a role. A bit more on him in a moment. But notice particularly that this is a stress on this as a civil war. It's internecine. It's something that makes it particularly blind and frenzied, and also helps to explain the intensity of the emotion and the pathos. Famous passage in Thucydides, the classic analysis of civil war at Corcyra in book 3, where again it's so much fiercer by being so close to home. It's for hate thy neighbour people. You may hate the neighbouring tribe, but God, you hate the person really next door even more, and so it goes on. Now, by now then, had they, presumably back to Caesar and Pompey, had they wished to rule in peace and enjoy their past achievements, the greatest and best parts of land and sea were already theirs, open for them to do so. Had they still wanted to gratify a thirst for trophies and triumphs, they could have drunk their fill of Parthian wars or German wars, Parthian extending Pompey's wars to the east, Germans, Caesar's to the north. And Scythia, too, was a great task that remained, and India as well. And they had an excuse which is not inglorious for such greed, for they could claim that they were civilizing the barbarians, a claim that we know, for instance, was made about Alexander, features heavily, not so much in Plutarch's own life of Alexander, but in a couple of his essays. But here, it might give us a bit of pause, I think. We might again recall the beginning of Lucan. But if we do, it'll be to notice contrast as well as a similarity. I should probably have put Lucan on the page, the handout, in fact. Lucan, if you remember, it was at least partly a matter of vengeance, Crassus needed to be avenged. But there certainly wasn't there in Lucan this casual assumption. It was just a matter of greed, or that any high-sounding words, any talk about civilizing a barbarians, were just excuses. Because it's not that Romans themselves are incapable of a much harder-headed view of what imperialism was about. The Aeneid itself has got some of that, as well as Parci Quimperner Amorem, Calgicus and Tacitus Agricola, and so on, Sallust's letter to Mithridates. But at Rome, I think still such ideas never quite lost their capacity to shock. And if we think particularly about greed, there's a lovely poem of Propertius, where Propertius imagines himself relaxing with his girlfriend, looking at Augustus's triumph, and rather as well reveling in being the naughty one who hasn't contributed to any way, and also represents it as a mere money-making expedition, the way you see Augustus got rich. I think it's still important that we feel that is really quite naughty. Propertius is being a bit wicked there. And for Plutarch, just to waft away this, all the complacency of imperialism away, to assume, make these best of the Greeks and some Romans and some non-participant Greeks assume, but any words of civilizing the barbarian world are just that, just only words. The reality is pure greed. That's something else, I think. And here we may well be at sensing a distinctive Greek outsider view of it all. So it's no surprise to find the emphasis on wealth continuing. What Scythian cavalry, Parthian arrows, or Indian wealth could have resisted 70,000 Romans attacking them in arms, Pompeian Caesar in command? It's a sort of military equivalent of the two men walking arm in arm into the sunset going off to cut a few barbarian throats. Perhaps to a sort of distant memory of Hector's momentary fantasy in Iliad 22, that he and Achilles might just put their weapons down and agree that Helen might be returned and everybody could just go home until he recalls this isn't the sort of man you can engage in lover's chat with. Pompey and Caesar, those men whose name the enemies had heard even before they heard of Rome. For such were the unapproachable, varied, savage tribes they traversed in arms. But now they came together to fight one another, feeling no pity even for their own glory, the thing which led them to be unsparing of their own country. Up to that day, for the name, they had name of being unconquered. The kinship they'd acquired, the charms of Julia, that marriage of Julia and Pompey, were from the outset matters of deception, mutual suspicion, question of hostage-taking, of a union that was put together for expediency, no true friendship about it. Great stuff. Well, remarks on the marriage of Julia and Pompey are in a way surprising. The narrative of a life itself has earlier stressed that that married couple, Julia and Pompey, were actually really deeply in love. And the author of A Life of Antony is never going to be a man to underrate the power of love, even among the great, especially among the great. But there are bigger emotions, pathé, in play too, these drives of power and glory and greed. Well, what I've said so far may conjure up a rather sniffy Plutarch, who's putting these poor, demented Romans in their place. We've come a long way by now from that cautious Plutarch I momentarily toyed with, the one who didn't want to be rude about the Roman masters. It sounds a bit like, if only they hadn't shown those distinctive Roman traits, things could have been so much better. And there are certainly times when the Greek Plutarch can manage a sniff, especially to suggesting that there are certain ways where Romans are different. There are also ways where Romans are worse. And they're particularly true when values of Greek education are in point. And this is handout 14. If only Marius had taken the trouble to learn Greek and Greek literature, probably in his youth, same with Coriolanus, then they wouldn't have become the sort of Roman soldiers they were. Fine on the battlefield, still with a lack of emotional self-control. Encouraged their aggressive tendencies when it came to politics. Plutarch would be great, actually, in this sort of debate on the value of the humanities. Make everybody learn Greek, and it'll all be perfectly all right. We needn't worry about anything else. Never mind the economy. He makes no bones either, Plutarch, about the Roman lack of aesthetic taste. He saw the marble columns, which were intended for Domitian's temples when they're waiting for shipping at Athens, that point they were perfectly proportioned. When I got to Rome, those dreadful Roman masons, they fouled it all up. They really screwed it up. They had a real mess of it. They now looked awful. That's in the Publicola. Yes, I put that reference down. Still, that sniffiness at the expense of Romans isn't the sort of thing we're talking about now. And there's an interesting extra perspective on that passage in the Pompey Vallongmen I took you through. Because the Pompey is paired with the Spartan king Agesilaus, and early in that life, Agesilaus is having a run of glorious success in Asia Minor. In fact, things are going so well that Agesilaus is thinking of launching an eastern campaign against Persia, and this is where we get to handout 16. This moment, news arrived from Sparta. A great Greek war, interesting way of putting it, is besetting them. And the Ephors are summoning him, magistrates of Sparta, commanding him to help the people at home. Oh, you Greeks, you're the inventors of barbarian evils. And that's a quotation from Euripides. In fact, it's Andromache in The Trojan Women, who is musing on the appalling things, the brutalities that the Greek conquerors are about to do to the Trojan, particularly to her son Astyanax. There it's a foreigner turning classic Greek complacency against the Greeks. You're the ones who are the real barbarians. Here it's more a point about one Greek, Agesilaus perhaps, Plutarch perhaps, aiming at other Greeks. And that's got a point as well, because it's precisely this Greek against Greek conflict that is causing all the problems, that combination and array of Greek forces against themselves. They turned upon one another. The arms had levelled against barbarians. Again, no doubt at all, but levelling arms against barbarians, fine, that's what they're for, go out and biff them. But they, instead, they're fighting one another. I don't agree myself with Demaratus of Corinth when he said that those Greeks had been robbed of a great pleasure, who had not seen Alexander sitting on Darius's throne. Now, I think they would have done better to weep at the thought that this had been left to Alexander by those who'd at that time expended the lives of Greek generals at Leuctra and Coronea, Corinth and in Arcadia, great Greek disasters. So Agesilaus meekly obeys orders and goes home. One remembers that Pompey had by now already had his great eastern conquests, just as Caesar had his northern ones. Agesilaus, by contrast, had not even got to the Spartan gate. So if there's sniffiness against Rome, there's even more sniffiness against the Greeks. Not just Romans, then, who lose the chance of glorious eastern conquest by a stupid, blind taste for self-destruction. Maybe an implied contrast of a dutiful Agesilaus who goes home and the great Roman dynasts, men who no longer know how to obey as well as to command. But the similarity between Greek and Roman may be greater than the differences. And what I think we're getting here, in fact, is a really very interesting play, something that one could argue more fully for Plutarch, of an awareness of national differences. It does make quite a big difference, for instance, to that difference between the generals. It may make even more of a big difference that the versions of this cutting each other's throats come out in a slightly different form on each side. In the Greek side, it's city against city. It's Athens against Sparta, Athens, Sparta against Corinth, Athens against Thebes. In the Roman side, it's Pompey against Caesar, just as earlier it was Marius against Sulla, or Octavius and Livius Drusus against the Gracchi. It's a fight about the individuals against one another. So there are differences. It comes out in different forms. And that's important. I want to get back to that when I do wrap up in just a few minutes' time. But there are also these similarities. And I was mentioning the big T, Thucydides, a few minutes ago. And that sort of combination of insistence on the importance of national differences, it matters that Athenians and Spartans are different, but also an awareness of a shared underlying human nature that they share, I think is very Thucydidean, in fact. And again, both Thucydides and Plutarch knew a thing or two about importance on both, stress on both similarities and differences. But certainly this, just to dwell a little bit more on the Greek side of this, because he does this sort of thing several times elsewhere as well, to reflect, or indeed that same ploy of making concerned observers reflect on what's going wrong with Greek. And it's particularly Greek contentiousness. There's an interesting passage in the Flamininus that I mentioned there, put that in the reference at least, in note 11, where Flamininus has made his great declaration at the Isthmus of Corinth, proclaiming the freedom of Greece, in a way that explicitly evokes memories of Nero doing the same thing in Plutarch's own generation. Plutarch may well have been there. And there the concerned observers think that, why have we not been able to do this ourselves? Why have we never been able to assert our own freedom? It's taken a Roman, a man of ambition, Philotimus, Flamininus, to come and do this for us. This pointing to the Greek disease is something that Plutarch loves to do. He's not simply sniffy at the expense of Greeks, of Romans. He can tell home truths to Greeks as well. Now, Flamininus, in fact, is paired with Philopoemen, the last of the great Greek freedom fighters. Very interesting pair, because they're contemporaries. They each, in fact, got a walk-on role in each other's life, and he never does that somewhere else. And the word for contentiousness used in that passage in the Flamininus is philonikia, and given there was some uncertainty about the etymology of that, is it love of victory, nike, or is it love of quarrels, nikos? Probably both etymologies are felt, in fact, but certainly the combativeness, the love of quarrels, is going to be felt as well as the love of victories. And Philopoemen most certainly is the sort of man who can start a fight in an empty room. He loves a quarrel. When he's short of a fight, he notices there's a war going on in Crete, and so he goes on and fights there, and has to work out which side he wants to be on. Now, there's a way in which Plutarch admires such a fierce commitment to freedom, Philopoemen as freedom fighter and national pride. And he begins there by quoting the praise of a certain Roman for Philopoemen as the last of the Greeks. And it's a fine and resonant phrase. But it also may remind us of something else, the mention in the Brutus of Cassius as the last of the Romans. We've got the last of the Greeks and the last of the Romans. But the way Philopoemen